right. Well, we're going to go ahead and get started. Looks like there's a lot of ski trip chaperones, apparently, that come to men's Bible study. I hope they're all having fun on their bus ride. All right, let us pray. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of the living God, have mercy upon us sinners. Amen. All right, we are to the last account. And this is page 35, number, the Martyrs of Vienne and Lyon. And I'm going to give a couple prefatory remarks. This one, like the account of Perpetua and Felicity, is too long for us to go through in its entirety. So I've given it to you, again, in its entirety so that you can take it and that you can go back and read the whole thing if you choose, if you haven't done it already. The other thing, then, about this is this is an instance where the martyrdom account is not technically from a first-hand source. And why I say technically is because, on the one hand, this is actually just one big long excerpt from a giant work by a fellow named Eusebius called The Church Histories, where he just goes through and basically says the history of Christianity up until this point, all of the things that have happened. And if you're a history kind of a guy, or if you're interested in this kind of thing, the martyrs, the early church, what happened, the Eusebius' Church Histories are really good and really interesting to read, and they're a great wealth. But they aren't... It's like writing down what has lived on in an oral tradition. So he's writing a ways after. So then there's always the question, well, then is this actually a good account? Again, technically not a first-hand source, because it's this other work. This is the kind of thing where if you were in grad school, you'd be docked points on your paper because you're not citing a primary source, you're citing a secondary source. That, by the way, drives me bonkers. After having worked as the editor for the Theological Journal for my graduate assistantship, reading papers where they say, this person says this, and then there's a footnote, and then you follow the footnote down, and it says a completely different name in a book that's completely unrelated, and you say, oh, you read a guy that said this guy said that, and then you said this guy said it, and you cited the other guy. That kind of stuff drives me bonkers. As Luther says here, footnote, Peter Brown, a biography of Luther. And like, oh, come on, that's not the same thing. So you can look at Eusebius and say, why are we bothering to read about the martyrs of Vienne and Lyon from Eusebius? Because it's technically not the first-hand source. However, Eusebius is where the first-hand source is preserved. That's the technicality here. Because in verse 4, he says, blah, 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 they talk about a few other things, and then they say, and he puts it in quotes. So at some point, all of this gets written down and passed down and passed down and passed down, and Eusebius has a copy of this, and he says, well, I should just include this in my histories, but it's pretty long, so I'll abridge it. And so at times Eusebius gives you the yada yada yada. Well, then they were here, and then the emperor came, and yada yada yada, then they all died. There you go. That's what you need to know. And so he'll intersperse the account here and there with things like, and then they talked about some of this stuff for a while, but let's get back to the martyrdom. And then he puts it back in quotes, because here's what the book actually says. Now, here is an interesting question. Where does the martyrdom account come from that Eusebius works from? how does everybody know about the martyrs of Vienne and Laon? Well, if you know anything about church history, you might know that there's a very famous bishop of Lyon. He wrote a lot of stuff. His name was Irenaeus. And he comes from Lyon. And he is the bishop that is put in place immediately following all of these persecutions. Because, and we're not going to really focus on that, because in order to abridge this, I'm going to focus mostly on one person for tonight. But in this big long list of all the different people who are martyred, one of them is the bishop. They take the bishop and they kill him. And what does the church do when somebody kills her bishop? She gets a new bishop. We just keep raising up bishops. Oh, they keep killing the bishops. All right, well, we'll keep raising them up. We'll keep doing it until they get tired of killing us. And Irenaeus is then the guy that is raised up to be the bishop, and he says, we need to write this down. We need to take care of this. We need to make a record of it. So Irenaeus writes down the account as the bishop of Lyon because he was there and he saw all the persecution and then became the bishop. And then that thing became so important, particularly for this region, that it survived. And then Eusebius somehow gets a hold of it and says, yeah, well, I don't care about all this stuff, but the little bits here and there about the actual martyrdoms, that's important. I'll copy that down too in my book. And then somehow or other, all of the other books kind of die, and what we're left with is what Eusebius, his copy that he copied. This is all fun, but let's dive in. Now, the very first thing I want to do is give you just a little bit of a background about what is the deal with Vienne and Lyon. Why on earth are the Christians being persecuted here? Well, okay, this is still Rome. This is what's called Roman Gaul. Caesar has the book, The Gallican Wars. He goes in and, you know, they fight with the Gauls. Who are the Gauls? Where is Gaul? It's kind of like France. It's that area. And that's before the Franks came, who were then the French. There's Franks, there's Goths, with the baggy pants and the eye makeup. There's Visigoths, and there's Gauls. And the Gauls, funnily enough, are my people. Celts. So before the Vikings decide to cross the river that way, my people had already become seafaring folk. And they crossed into Europe from Britain. And then they settle there. So there's a lot of cool archaeological there are many cool archaeological discoveries that have been found where in this former province of Roman Gaul, they have Celtic artifacts. They wear the little necklaces called torque, which is like a horseshoe with balls on the end, and you would pull it apart to put it on your neck and then squish it down. The Romans were afraid of the Gauls in Gaul because they were not afraid to die, and they painted themselves, and they were giant people because they ate milk and cheese and meat instead of grain and fish. So the Romans go up to fight and they see these giant naked people painted blue running out of the forest and they are afraid of them. And then of course they go to Britain and they see more of those people and they build a wall and say, the world ends here. Right? So these people come here. So they are these Druidic pagans who are now occupied by the Romans and the Roman pantheon. And then all of a sudden, these Christians start popping up. But the Christians are not native to Gaul. The Christians actually are coming in mostly from Turkey. And they look different. Why are they coming in? Business maybe, following trade routes, but also probably fleeing other persecution. But they look different, they talk different, they don't behave like Romans, they don't behave like Gauls. And they have all these strange ideas about how worship is supposed to be done and who God is and what all this is about. So in a dark way, it's a little bit funny because the Christians come to Gaul and not only are they hated by the Romans, they're also hated by the Gauls. Everybody looks at them and says, "You guys are so weird, I just want to kill you." So that's where the story begins, right there at 4. The greatness of the tribulation in this region and the fury of the heathen against the saints and the sufferings of the blessed witnesses. Now, of course, you should know enough by this point to be able to answer this question. And I purposely did not put it in the handout as a test. These witnesses. What word do you think that is? Witnesses. Martyria. The witnesses, the martyrs. They give witness, they bear testimony in their death. Martyria. We cannot recount accurately, nor indeed could they possibly record it. It's too much. It's sort of like when John writes at the end of the gospel, "Oh yeah, Jesus did all these things, and he did way more, and he said way more things than are in this book. And he said and did way more than could fit in any book, in fact. But these are the things that we have hand-selected for you to know." That's this. Boy howdy, way too much stuff has happened. Too many people died. "For with all his might," this is very important. This is going to frame for you everything we're going to look at. "With all his might," singular or plural? Singular. "The adversary fell upon us." Who is the adversary? Take a guess. Not the Romans and not the Gauls. The devil. Now, I want you to think, these are the things that always happen in hindsight. When I get up to teach, and then I look at the text and I go, "Oh, duh, why didn't you think about putting this and this and this and this and this in the handout?" Paul says in Ephesians, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. We don't, why not? Because we don't have any enemies. Christians don't have enemies. Why not? Because Jesus doesn't have enemies. What's an enemy? Somebody you hate in your heart. That's the understanding of an enemy. Enemy is not the person who's fighting against you. That's your adversary or your opposition. Your enemy is the person you hate in your heart and have turned your heart against. Enemy starts here. So who's the real enemy at the gates? It's you. So you don't have any enemies because Jesus says, hey, you got to love everybody. And if you love everybody, you can't have an enemy because your heart is never turned against them. It's always for them. But you do fight against one. But it isn't flesh and blood because, of course, you don't have any enemies. But it is the adversary, the devil. And this is so important because, like all of these martyrdom accounts, there's been a particular angle. And I hope that you have noticed that as I've taken you through these. Polycarp, what's the angle? It's Eucharistic. Perpetua, what's the angle? It's baptism, it's identity. It's new life in Christ. It's that kind of angle. But here, the martyrs of Vienne and Lyon, what's the angle? Spiritual warfare. That the martyrdoms are the battle that is raging, manifesting in the world. There's more happening in the world than you could possibly imagine, let alone see. And the battles rage, and you don't even realize how fiercely they rage around you. And every now and then, they poke their heads out and are manifested. Like a finger puppet. I'm much bigger than the puppet, but you see the puppet. The battle that rages manifests itself in these ways. These persecutions here, the Christians say, this is the manifestation of our battle with the adversary, the devil. And what does the devil look like? Well, first of all, he's filled with rage. Look at this, the fury of the heathen. Rage. By the way, this isn't the first time where you've had servants of God versus servants of somebody else. The big one that I can think of, and maybe you can think of more, but the big one I can think of is Elijah and the prophets of Baal. It's me versus them. And it's not really about me versus them. It's about God versus whatever that is. I'm not fighting against the priests. I'm fighting against the one the priests serve. You get the sense a little bit with Moses and Aaron when they go to Pharaoh. Think of throwing the rod down and having it become a snake. And then the other magicians say, oh, well, we learned how to do that first year of magic school, bop. And they do it. And then, of course, Moses' snake eats the other snakes. But you still have this sense of, oh, we can do that too. That's how you want to play? We can do it. And the miraculous thing about that is they reach a certain point where even they look at Pharaoh and they say, we lost. We can't compete anymore. That God is better. We can't do it. And of course, then the question becomes, what are they exactly doing, those magicians? Are they magicians like we think of magicians? I mean, does Pharaoh employ Penn and Teller up there? Hey, catch a bullet. You show those Israelites a fun trick. Hey, Moses, pick a card. It's not understood that way. We just think of magic as an illusion. Oh, it's a trick. It's fun. Everybody knows it's not real. Actually, this is why my mom hates magic. Because my mom says, they're all liars, and I know they're lying, and it makes me mad that I can't figure out how they're lying. I don't like to be fooled. But that's the entertainment. I'm fooled. Wow, that was cool. How do you put the egg through the wall? Whoa! But here, the adversary, the magicians of Pharaoh, they're doing something real. It's not illusion. They really do make snakes go. They really do turn little cups of water into blood. They can't turn a whole river. They're really doing things by a different power, Elijah and Baal. Who is Moses really fighting against? Not Pharaoh. Think about it. When Moses says, who shall I say sent me? What's the name? I am. Which means, who else can be? Who else is? Nobody. Only I am. And then he goes to Egypt and he says, the God of the Hebrews is the only God. He is God. There isn't any other God. It's just him. He wants you to let the people go. Oh no, that's funny. We've got about 12 other gods that beg to differ. And then you stop and think a minute. Each one of those plagues is actually war. God is quick drawing on the gods of Egypt. River God. Sun God. God of the harvest. And they all fall like Texas Red. You know the song. Big Iron. When Saoirse was really little, she used to call it Big Iron. And I miss those days when she'd walk around and say, Daddy, can we listen to Big Iron again? So, it's all framed with war. The persecutions, well, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they do. There's a deeper power behind them. This is war. This is what the battle looks like. You want to be baptized? That means you're getting drafted. Baptism is a draft. You're in the war now. And that's what it looks like. And that's one reason the Christians are all so happy to suffer martyrdom. Well, we knew this was going to happen. Of course, we're brought into a battle. But it's okay. We're fighting a battle, but the war's already won. So what's the deal? Now, I want to share with you this quote. The persecutors are filled with rage. This is top of page 2. This quote is from an exorcist, and he has this little blog, and he talks about certain things. But this particular blog post was about the all-consuming rage of the demonic. Rage, anger. I continue to be stunned by the unrelenting rage of evil. And I'm sharing this with you because it ties so well into Sunday morning Bible class. Look at this. The topic has changed and somehow everything still fits. Isn't St. John beautiful? Satan and his minions are consumed by a violent rage against God and anyone who follows him. Anyone who follows him. War. Who is fighting against the martyrs? The devil, the adversary. They hate everyone and even their fellow demons. They will spend their eternity spewing forth rage and desiring to control and to destroy. Weeping and gnashing of teeth. Everybody's bitter and angry. Gnashing of teeth like the dog. And conversely, the people of God are filled with joy. And because they're filled with joy, they are hated all the more. The more joyful you get, the more angry the devil gets. I can't believe it. He's like the Grinch. Except for instead of having a change of heart, he gets madder. And he says, what more can I take from them? For with all his might, the adversary fell upon us, giving us a foretaste of his unbridled activity at his future coming. That's a whole Bible study there. It's a reference to Revelation. But he's on a leash, don't worry. He endeavored in every manner to practice and exercise his servants, look at that, his servants against the servants of God. War. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. They've gone mad. They're crazy. They're rabid. They've been taken over by our adversary. They're being used like pawns. Even they don't know what's really going on. And of course, they worship idols. So if you worship idols, who are you really serving? See? You become a servant, but you don't always know exactly who you're serving. unless you're serving God. If you're serving God, you know exactly who you're serving. Anybody else, that starts to get dangerous. There's real power out in the world. There really is. I tell you what, I am 34 years old, and I have seen an awful lot of stuff. More than a 34-year-old probably should. I have seen real power. Earthly power. I've seen crazy things. And you want to know what? It's all a show. But it's all real. That isn't pick a card. But the thing is, magic in its true sense, it's radioactive. You even do this, and you start glowing, and then all of the demons with their little Geiger counters are gonna go where it clicks. All it takes is this, and now they're after you. So you start worshiping all these gods, and whose servant do you become? The adversaries. God has many names, but he's one. The devil has many names too. So they shut us out from houses and baths and markets and forbid us to be seen in any place whatsoever. But the grace of God led the conflict against him and delivered the weak and set them as firm pillars, able through patience to endure all the wrath of the evil one. And they joined battle with him. How do they fight? This is so great. Because, I mean, when you look at injustice, and believe you me, I'm with you. Because underneath all of the pastor, I'm a guy. And what do you think with the injustice? All right, let's take care of that. I mean, maybe you aren't as Gaul, Celt, Pictish as I am, because that's sort of my response to everything. What was that? That's how I want to do it, right? And the Christians say, yeah, we did go to battle with him, but not like this. Oh yeah, Satan, you want to go? You'll never catch me. We went to battle undergoing all kinds of shame and injury and regarding their great sufferings as little. How do we go to battle with the devil? By suffering much and by being joyful. By staying with Jesus. By not recanting. By being a disciple. What can the devil possibly do? Throw more persecution at us? Oh no, throw some more, huh? He can't ever undo what Jesus has done. And again, I point to Polycarp. What's the fire? How long is it going to burn? 5, 10 minutes? How long do you think it's going to take for me to pass out either from the smoke or from the pain? 5 minutes? 10 minutes? 15 minutes? Maybe 20 minutes? But think in the grand scheme of things how long 15 minutes is compared with the eternity of damnation that I don't have to worry about now. And if the one thing I do in my life, if the one big thing I really have to suffer is being thrown into a fire for 10, 15 minutes before I pass out, you know what? In the grand scheme of things, that is definitely worth it. And what am I gaining by recanting? I'm saving 5, 10, or 15 minutes. And in the grand scheme of things, I'm not actually saving all that much. So a cost-benefit analysis tells me it's actually a better investment to be a martyr. That's how they do battle. See? The sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed to us afterward. What's suffering? It's nothing. All right, so I want to jump just a little bit. I do want to say one thing. I don't have it here quite yet in the text, but just so that we can kind of move through the handout. Here's the battle. They're going to behave like demons, and or they're going to be angry like demons, but they're also going to behave like wild beasts. Oh yeah, here it is. Page 37, verse 14. That's where we're going. Good, I found it. And some of our foreign servants also were seized, as the governor had commanded that all of us should be examined publicly. This, and in a bunch of verses before, one of the things that you notice, and you have seen this through the majority of these martyrdom accounts, there's always a percentage of the Christians that fall away, that either looking at the torture say, ooh, no way, I don't want to do that, or under torture say, never mind, I give it all up. I give it all up. There's always that percentage, which should make you think of the parable of the sower. Handfuls of seeds everywhere, which, if you know anything about agriculture, is probably a dumb idea, just to recklessly throw your vegetable seeds all over the place. Yes, a little bit in the street, a little bit here on the sidewalk. Here, you know, the hedges are in here, but I'm sure they'll find a place to grow through the hedges, right? Just reckless. I'm not being careful about where I'm planting it. I'm not being careful about the nutrients. I'm not being careful about where it's going to get sun. I'm not being careful about rotating through the crops to make sure that the soil's not getting... I'm just throwing it out there. And of course, recklessness is always in the parables a characteristic of God, because love is irrational and reckless. Think of the things that love will make you do that nothing else will motivate you to do. Think of the things that you would do, say, for your wife or for your children that you wouldn't do for anybody else. And think of the times that you would look at your wife and say, you know, you're really lucky you're my wife, because I would not do this for anybody else. Everybody's had that moment. And I know I'm a little younger than most of you, but if you haven't had that moment, you definitely will. At least one. Boy, if I wasn't married to you, if I didn't love you. I've got so many stories to tell for another time, over a beer. So, you know, not till after Lent for me. Right? So there's always some that fall away. The seed is scattered recklessly because he wants even the smallest chance. I'll take every chance. And if I don't throw seed over here under the sidewalk, there's a chance that some of that seed might not fall into some of the in-between cracks and actually start to grow tomato plants. And what I would love is for every crack of every sidewalk to be filled up with grapevines and tomato plants. So in order for that to happen, I have to make sure I throw as much seed out as is possible. And that means a lot of it's not going to actually do anything. There's some that are going to grow up and it's going to look really good and then it's going to fall over. It has no roots, nothing to cling to. And this is what you see. So they were seized, and these being ensnared by Satan, here it is, that battle between Satan. It's not that they're afraid of the tortures. It's not this, it's not that. It's like Judas, ensnared by Satan. Satan enters into him. I don't say this to brag, because I don't want to do that. I wrote an article that was published in a little Lutheran journal called Logia. But the whole article was about Satan's role in the Passion narratives. That when you actually read the Passion account of Jesus, what you see happening behind the scenes is that Satan is putting a guy here. Satan is steering a person here. Satan is doing this. Satan's going, hey, wait a minute. We should crucify him. And people go, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, yeah. You see all of these little tweaks, and he's playing a game of chess. We're going to do this. We're going to move this guy here. We're going to do this. And he thinks that he's thinking way far ahead. And even something as throwaway as what Pastor Brusick brought up in Bible class on Sunday. And Satan waited until an opportune time. Jesus beat him in the wilderness, but Satan doesn't go, well, all right, I guess that one's a lost cause. Every defeat of Satan is something he learns from. There's a comic book character in the DC universe, none of this Marvel stuff, called Amazo. And Amazo's an android, but he can scan superheroes and he gets their powers once they show him. So he scans, you know, Superman, and then Superman uses his heat vision, and all of a sudden now Amazo has heat vision too, and he can't lose it. Every time you do something new, every time you have another strategy to defeat Amazo, he learns it, so you can't use it against him the next time. He's always scanning, looking, learning. The devil's kind of like Amazo. When Jesus beats him here, he goes, oh, okay, all right, so that's not going to work. Well, let's figure this out. I bet you we can do this instead. We'll go here and we'll do this. Hey, look at that guy. He likes money. Maybe I'll go talk to him a little bit. I'll get him on my side. Well, let's get all these people. Let's get everything lined up. And all the dominoes are in a row. And then Jesus comes right in front of him and he goes, now I'll get him. That's the way he works. So they are ensnared, and fearing for themselves the tortures which they beheld the saints endure, and being also urged by the soldiers, here's the big point, accused us falsely of Thyestean banquets and Oedipean intercourse. Intercourse. And of other deeds which are not only unlawful for us to speak of or to think, but that which we cannot believe were ever done by men. And they said, oh yeah, the Christians do all those things. So what are Thyestean banquets and Oedipodian intercourse? Well, let me put it in regular terms. It's cannibalism and incest. Why? Because they say they eat body and drink blood. So they're cannibals. And here's, I've got a little medieval illumination here from the Greek myth about Atreus and Thyestes. It's a Thyestean feast because the character in Greek myth named Thyestes ate human flesh in a soup. There was another story about that. Tantalus, you know, like the word we have tantalize, ooh, that's tantalizing. That comes from Greek, from the character named Tantalus, because in hell, Tantalus's punishment is that he's stuck in a pool of mud. No, he's stuck in a pool of water. And every time he puts his head down to try and take a drink, it lowers just out of his reach, so he can't actually ever take a drink. And there's a plant hanging right over his head with a big fruit on it. And every time he tries to reach up to take a bite, it's just a little, you know, just a bit outside. It's Tantalus. Why is Tantalus in hell? Why is that his punishment? Because he chopped up his son and put him in a soup and tried to feed him to the gods to see if they would notice. And you know what? Only one of them didn't. Demeter, she's all upset because her daughter got taken into the underworld and forced to marry the king of hell. Whatever. she ate the kid's shoulder. So then, you know, this is the funny story. They dump out the soup and they put the boy together and they say, oh, he's missing a shoulder. And Demeter says, my tummy hurts. So then they make him a new one. So now this boy walks around and he's got like a gold shoulder. Hey, everybody. Demeter ate my shoulder. Thyestean banquets. And then Oedipus, you know, like an Oedipus complex. Incest. Oedipus marries his mom. Because the prophecy says he will. So he tries not to. Ugh, bad move. Don't you know if the prophecy says you're going to, you never try not to, because it's in the trying not to that you do it. Ugh. Everybody knows that. So Christians are cannibals because they eat the body and the blood, and they're incestuous because they call each other brother and sister, and yet they still get married. Ugh. What do they want, a bunch of kids with six toes? Ugh. So we're going to kill them. Okay, now, I want to jump down a little bit. This is the bottom of this same page. It's verse 17, but it's sort of that second paragraph. This is one of the main characters that I want to talk about. Blandina. So she, in Gaul, Vienne and Lyon, is famous the way Perpetua is famous in North Africa. Blandina. It's a very kind of Gaulish name. Their wrath was also roused against Blandina, through whom Christ showed that things which appear mean and obscure and despicable to men are with God of great glory, though love toward through love toward him manifested in power and not boasting in appearance. Now, I shouldn't think that this is as funny as I do, but I do, because what are they saying? She was really ugly. That's what they say. Ah, you know, things that appear mean and obscure and despicable. Ugh. She was really ugly, but you know what? Christ made her beautiful. All right. They didn't have an editor on this one. Say, hey, you know, I don't think we really need to keep that line in there. Oh, no. It makes the whole thing. You got to know this. Now, I have the quote in here for you on the handout on page 4, but I'm not going to read it. Roald Dahl wrote this book called The Twits. And there's a quote I love. It's right at the very beginning of The Twits. And it basically just says, hey, if you think ugly thoughts and do ugly things, it doesn't matter how pretty you are, you turn ugly and everybody looks at you and you're ugly. But you can be as ugly as sin. You can be as ugly as the dog next door. And if you're really beautiful on the inside, it shines out of you and it makes you beautiful. And it's this whole thing. Jesus makes you beautiful. You can be ugly as the dog next door and Jesus makes you beautiful. And what Jesus lets you do also makes you beautiful. So Blandina, you know, she's a little ugly, but she's beautiful because of what Jesus allowed her to do. For while we all trembled and her earthly mistress, what is Blandina? A slave. A slave girl showed up all of Vienne and Lyon, who was herself also one of the witnesses, feared that on account of the weakness of her body, she would be unable to make a bold confession. And Blandina was filled with such power as to be delivered and raised above those who were torturing her by turns from morning till evening in every manner, so that they acknowledged that they were conquered. War. Blandina gets tortured all day, all night. They take turns. All right, my shift's done. You're up. And they couldn't break her. And even they said, man, like the magicians of Pharaoh, we're beat. Well, I don't know what's up with this. Ah, but the Christians understand because framing this in the context of a war, not between us and them, but between us and him. Now you see it's like Jesus' temptation in the wilderness. Ah, rats, he's bested me this time. But of course, I'll just come back here and I'm just gonna wait until a more opportune time. So of course, Blandina is a martyr. They couldn't do anything to her, and they were astonished at her endurance as her entire body was mangled and broken. And they testified that one of these forms of torture was sufficient to destroy life, not to speak of so many. Even one of these things should have broken her. And we did all of them. She's some kind of special. But the blessed woman, like a noble athlete, renewed her strength in her confession. And of course, here we go again. Confession, witness, testimony, the martyria, the martyrdom that is not just about dying for Jesus, but living for him as well. Living for him so that if you should die for him, even your death is a testament to the life you live in him. All right, now let's jump to the next page, the very top. I only want to read this one thing to show you that even though some of the seed goes into places where the plants grow up and they fall down and don't have root, there is still hope. And the devil, thinking that he had already consumed Biblias, who was one of those who had denied Christ, desiring to increase her condemnation through the utterance of blasphemy, brought her again to the torture. I mean, this is the cruelty of it all. This is a woman who already recanted, never mind, I'm not a Christian anymore, and they decided, you know what, I know she gave up on it, but just for fun, let's bring her back and torture her some more. What are you gaining? I mean, you're not even gaining your own life by recanting. And actually, there is a whole chunk in here where all of the people that recant think that they're going to then get off. Oh, whew. And then the Romans decide, put him back in prison. We've got more in store for them. So they have now recanted Christ and still suffer just the same way that the Christians do. And because they don't care about Christ, they have nothing to suffer for. And in the grand narrative picture here, that is hell. Getting exactly what you wanted and realizing it's no good. Like the Twilight Zone, my dear boy, whoever told you this was heaven. Everything I've ever wanted. And you know what? It's boring. I don't like it. There's no thrill of going to the casino if I win every single time. That's fun for a while, but what makes the casino fun is the thrill of the chance. I could lose, and I probably will, but I could win. That's why I don't go to casinos. So, they brought her again, already feeble and weak, to bear false witness. But she recovered herself under the suffering, and as if awaking from a deep sleep, and reminded by the present anguish of the eternal punishment in hell, she contradicted the blasphemers. How, she said, could those eat children who do not think it lawful to taste the blood even of irrational animals? Oh yeah, by the way, the cannibalism in particular was that they were killing babies. They were killing babies and eating babies. That was the particular charge. How could they kill babies? And how could they eat children when they don't even drink the blood of the animals? And thenceforward, she confessed herself a Christian and was given a place in the order of the witnesses. What does that phrase mean? Well, it's loaded. Given a place in the order of the witnesses. At base level, what does it mean? means she was a martyr. She was killed. Witnesses, the martyrs, martyria. She's given a place among them. Okay, fine, you want to be that way? You'd go join them. Go die with all the rest of them. Amen. Okay, I will. If there was a persecution coming through here, I would want to die with all of you. I just think about St. John, the only one of the apostles not to die from martyrdom. And they tried, it didn't take. And you look at these people and they have a joy. The church is a body. They have a joy as the body. We have a joy to come together and live together and eat together and be together, and we have a joy to die together too. And to have some people die and you left out, that's actually kind of a sad thing. John, he's still alive, we'll send him over here. And all of his friends and his brothers and his cousins and his fellow apostles, they're all put to death for Christ, and he says, man, you know, I would have liked to have been with them. Landine is numbered among them. Fine, go and be among them. But also, on a deeper level here, beyond just the literal, she receives a place in the order of the martyrs in heaven. That Biblias is one of those under the altar, one of those putting on the white robes, one of those, like last week from the sermon from Augustine, who is getting a greater reward for having paid a greater price. She is ranked now among them, not among a traitor. Why is this important? Why take the time away from Blandina now to focus on Biblias? Because Jesus says the guy goes out to the marketplace even at the 11th hour. It's 4:00. Do you want to come work at my 9-to-5? What guy's going to do that? Nobody. But Jesus does. Even at the last, I'll go out and I will bring you in and I'll welcome you. How last minute can it be? First of all, let me put a big disclaimer here. Best not to put the Lord to the test. So the question, how last minute can it be, is sort of a bad question. There was a period in time where Christians said, you know what, baptism is so great, it's going to forgive all these sins. I actually am going to get all of my sinning in my whole life done and then get baptized and have them all wiped out just like that right before I die. I say, hold, don't touch that water to me yet. All right, quit. Do it now. They wait. How long can I wait? The church doesn't do that because that was a bad idea. How late is late? Well, Dismas, the thief on the cross, look at him. That's pretty late. But even for somebody like Dismas, there's more rejoicing in the kingdom of heaven than over the other 99 who have been there the whole time. All right, let's jump again. Next page. If you want the picture of hell, here it is. At the top, the first two-thirds of this page, page 40, that's hell. Getting what you asked for. Getting what you want forever. And you just happen to realize now what you wanted is bad. But I'm looking at verse 36. Here it is, yada, 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 some more, they say. After these things, the martyrdoms were divided into every form. For pleading a crown of various colors and of all kinds of flowers, they presented it to the Father. It was proper, therefore, that the noble athletes, having endured a manifold strife and conquered grandly, should receive the crown great and incorruptible. A sweet-smelling aroma. So here is the beginning of the martyrdom. So to the next page now, 41. We're on verse 41, page 41, verse 41. Providence is real. Blandina was suspended on a stake and exposed so as to be devoured by the wild beasts who should attack her. Guys, warfare. Remember what I said last week, Mark's gospel. We gotta have four gospels. And people, oh, Mark's the shortest gospel. It's got the least amount of stuff in it. Whatever, man. It might be the shortest of the gospels, but it sure doesn't have the least amount of stuff. Mark is the only gospel that says, yeah, Jesus goes up into the wilderness after his baptism, and there were wild beasts there. Jesus goes to the wild beasts and beats them. I mean, like at a game, he doesn't. He conquers them. And now, the martyrdoms framed within the context of this great spiritual battle, she is tied to a stake, so the wild beasts will devour her. The wild beasts. And because she appeared as if hanging on a cross, and because of her earnest prayers, she inspired the combatants with great zeal. Combatants, the fighters, that is the other martyrs, because it's a battle, not against flesh and blood, but against Satan. For they looked on her in her conflict and beheld with their outward eyes in the form of their sister him who was crucified for them. She looked like Jesus, and for a moment the sun hit just right and they were all so close to dying, they looked at her and she wasn't her anymore. All of a sudden they saw Jesus. A glorious image, that he might persuade those who believe in him, that everyone who suffers for the glory of Christ has fellowship always with the living God. And then none of the wild beasts touched her. Why not? Well, what did you think the wild beasts were going to do? Jesus already conquered the wild. I work for the guy that conquered the wild beasts. They're not going to touch me. But I also want to talk about this, her being raised up. And she looks like Jesus, and they have this beatific vision where they look at her and they say, oh, it's Blandina. And then they look down and then they look back up and they say, whoa, it's Jesus. On the one hand, you can say, ah, yes, great. You're finally fully conformed to the image of Christ. That's what it should be. Everybody who looks at you should see Jesus. We all should kind of look the same. Now, I don't watch the show The Goldbergs. In fact, I don't actually even know what the show The Goldbergs is about. But I had a parishioner in Missouri who sent me a clip from an episode of The Goldbergs where all these young men were pretending to be doctors. And they were going around shaking each other's hand, calling each other doctor. But there were like eight of them. So it was always, hello, doctor, doctor, ah, doctor, doctor, oh, doctor, doctor, ah, doctor, 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 doctor. And it was pretty funny. But I think of that here because heaven's going to be a little bit like that. Ah, Jesus, 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 Jesus. Oh, Jesus. Oh. Because every single one of us is going to be shining out like Jesus. And of course, you're going to be able to tell the difference. Everybody's going to look just like they are, but somehow way better, because you're going to be able to look at them and see every good thing that they've ever done, just shining right on out of them. And they're also going to look just like Jesus, but, you know, like little Jesus. Hey, we're all little Christs. But there's also then the beatific vision. That all of a sudden, like the, hey, remember the Swiss cheese holes? I thought that was a pretty good image. This is one of those Swiss cheese holes where Jesus pokes his head out. And they look down and it's Blandina and he does one of these. And now it's him. Whoa, here is Christ. And it becomes this battle standard. What's the point of the battle standard? Not just to say, this is the cavalry. It's motivation. Why? Think of the Iwo Jima, the flag. Why is that such a good image? There isn't a person in America that doesn't look at that image and get that fiery sense of American pride. Those are my boys. That's my flag. Yeah, atta boy. It fills you with that sense of courage and hope and flames you with the desire to keep going. And she becomes that, the battle standard in this great war, so that all the soldiers, combatants, can die well. Yes, look at that. Now I want to share something with you. This is another one of those kicking myself that I didn't think of this until right before class. There's a great hymn in here that hardly anybody knows, and it's called Christ is the World's Redeemer. It has a weird Irish tune, but it's written by St. Columba of Iona, who was Irish, who came to Scotland and founded a monastery in Scotland. I love St. Columba. You know, just this is completely unrelated, but it's so good you have to know it. St. Columba rebuked the Loch Ness Monster. True story. It's written in a book from the time period. The life of St. Columba, Vita Columba. A fisherman was crying and screaming, and he ran down to the loch, and the boat had been destroyed, and there was Nessie. And he waded into the water, and he said, "Begone, you foul creature, in the name of Jesus." And went back in. It's right there in the book. And that's why I believe in Nessie. Because my mother, the church, never tells a lie. And it's in her books. Okay? But look at this great line here. Stanza 2. Christ has our host surrounded with clouds of martyrs bright who wave their palms in triumph and fire us for the fight. Cool. That's Blandina. I think about this at All Saints Day this year. It's a completely different tone. Okay. So, yes, she dies. Let's go here to the very end. This is page 43. Okay, after all these things, the last day, Blandina's still alive. They can't kill her. With a little boy. But because they remained so steadfast, the multitude became furious. Ah, the devil, always mad. I can't get them. Why won't they die? Angry. So they exposed them to all kinds of terrible sufferings and took them through the entire round of torture. Give up Jesus, we won't. But the blessed Blandina, last of all, having as a noble mother encouraged her children and sent them all before, she's the very last martyr, she looked after everybody else, she made sure everybody else got to go. Sent them before her victorious king, endured herself all their conflicts, and hastened after them, glad and rejoicing in her departure, as if called to a marriage supper. Because of course she was. Heaven is the great marriage supper with the best wine, and you don't have to worry about the next day. And after the scourging, after the wild beast, after the roasting seat, ooh, she was finally enclosed in a net and thrown before a bull. And having been tossed about by the animal, but feeling none of the things which happened to her, she also was sacrificed. Look at that. Even this language. Even when they die, it's a sacrifice. Who does their blood go to? It goes to Jesus. They are a sacrifice. And the heathen themselves confessed that never among them had a woman endured so many and such terrible tortures. Blandina. Now I want to share one last thing on this handout, and then we'll go and pray. This is along the lines of this Columba hymn, St. Columba hymn. Christ has our host surrounded with bands, with hosts of martyrs bright, who wave their palms in triumph and far us for the fight. The battle standard. And here at the amphitheater of Three Gauls, this is in Lyon, this is still here, the amphitheater where all of these martyrdoms happened. It's still standing. You can go there. And in there, they have a post. They say it's the same post that was there that they used to tie Blandina to. And they keep it there as a reminder of Blandina and the martyrdoms that she witnessed and then underwent herself. But the battle standard, it still stands. Our flag was still there. The post is still there. Why does that matter? Well, it's cool for history. And it's a nice thing to be able to, like, you go to Jerusalem and walk on the Roman road and you can say, hey, my feet touched the same stones that Jesus touched. Well, you can do that in the sanctuary too. Stones of the sanctuary came from Jerusalem. You might be walking on the same place Jesus walked. But it's more than just the interest. It's also the reality that the battle standard is still there. The martyrs are still preaching. And all of them, not just Blandina, but all the ones that we have read here, every single one of them becomes for us a model, an encouragement to live as martyrs, even if we never die as martyrs. All right, let's go pray. 424 on the hymn, same one. We'll see you down there.